This is Tall Tales Time. Legends of long ago, stories from the day before yesterday. Settle back into your chair and listen as we spin for you Tall Tales. Tonight, a crisis in the career of Matthew Fontaine Murray, the sailor from the backwoods of Tennessee, the naval lieutenant who single-handed brought about a revolution in the science of navigation.
All ye young fellas that follow the sea, to my way, hey, blow the man down. Pray pay attention and listen to me, and give me some time to blow the man down.
It's June. The year is 1831. A sailor is home from the sea. Midshipman Matthew F. Murray of Tennessee is back after 5 years of sailing the oceans of the world. Roses are blooming now in Georgetown on the Potomac River, where the girl he loves waits for him. Matthew gives her a seal to inscribe her letters to him.
The word on the seal is Mizpah. It's from the Bible, Anne, remember? It means the Lord watch between thee and me when we are absent one from the other.
Black, black is the color of my true love's hair. Her lips are like some rosy fair, the prettiest face and the neatest hands. I love the ground where she stands.
My mother and father were married in 1834. In the decades that followed, my father, Matthew Fontaine Murray, became a famous man. Emperors and kings, a Russian Grand Duke wrote to him and presented him with medals. My mother presented him with children. Not so numerous as the medals, but a houseful. We weren't rich. When Father was paid $50 for a speech, we shouted for joy. And when the merchants and marine underwriters of New York City gave him a silver service and a purse of $5,000, well, we thought it must be nearly all the money in the world.
He never became a wealthy man. Matthew Murray's first fame came to him in the years after his marriage to Anne Herndon. He wrote a book based on his 9 years of constant sailing of the seven seas, and he called it A New Theoretical and Practical Treatise on Navigation.
Man, come in here and listen. Listen to this review of my book in the Southern Literary Messenger. He likes the book. And here he's talking about naval officers. Where was the paragraph? Here, listen. He says, the time is coming when, imbued with a taste for science and a spirit of research, they will become ardent explorers of the regions in which they sojourn. The enthusiast in science will anxiously await their return after the perils of a distant voyage. And he signed the review, Edgar Allan Poe.
So many things interested my father. First and last, of course, was the Navy. It was always closest to his heart. He had a restless, inquiring mind. And there was the time, after he suffered a badly broken leg and thigh in a train wreck, when he spent 3 months teaching himself to speak and write French. And then there was astronomy, which he talked about like a poet.
At night, when the world is hushed in sleep, I turn to the astronomical almanac and find there that when the clock tells a certain hour, a star which I never saw before will be in the field of the telescope a minute, flit through, and then disappear. I look. The star, mute with eloquence that gathers sublimity from the silence of the night, comes smiling and dancing into the field, and at the instant predicted, even to the fraction of a second, it makes its transit and is gone.
Night are pinned back by the stars, and the beautiful moon sweeps the sky. I'll remember you, love, in my prayers.
The years passed quickly. Murray became a lieutenant. And in 1842, he was named superintendent of the Navy's depot of charts and instruments, later to be known as the Naval Observatory. He began his wind and current charts of the oceans of the world, the North Atlantic first, and then the sailing route to Rio, the Pacific, and the Indian Ocean. For the first time, ship captains knew where and when to take advantage of prevailing winds and currents, and they began to set new sailing records around Cape Horn, from England to Australia.
The dauntless 80 days out of Melbourne, Australia, now entering Bristol Harbor.
In the old days, the voyage from Australia to England took 120 days. Murray's charts and instructions cut the time by one-third, an immense boon to commerce. And then Lieutenant Murray, now in his 40s, took up perhaps his greatest work, the book that won for him the right to be called the world's first great oceanographer.
There is a river in the ocean. In the severest droughts it never fails, and in the mightiest floods it never overflows. Its banks and its bottom are cold water. Its current is warm. The Gulf of Mexico is its fountain, and its mouth is in the Arctic seas. It is the Gulf Stream. There is in the world no other such majestic flow of waters.
The man who knew the riddles of the ocean depths received word of a strange project in the year 1854.
We'd appreciate your help with projected plan to submerge telegraphic cable and Atlantic Ocean. Newfoundland or Labrador to Irish coast. Your knowledge of deep sea soundings invaluable. Signed, Cyrus W. Field.
He was famous now. His books were celebrated on both sides of the Atlantic. He was an honored advisor in the transatlantic cable project. And at the request of the Secretary of the Navy, he planned a system of coastal defense for the United States. But dark days lay ahead for Lieutenant Matthew Murray, the self-taught scientist and ocean expert who had grown up in Frontier, Tennessee, in the tiny village of Franklin. He aroused the hostility of certain men high in the ranks of the Navy, and in 1855, they seized the opportunity to humiliate him.
Come in. Letter for you, Lieutenant Murray, sir, from the Navy Board. Shall I wait for an answer, sir?
No, son, I'll call you if I need you.
Yes, sir.
From the Navy Board, eh? Lieutenant M.F. Murray. Sir, in regard to the Act of Congress passed February 28, 1855, and signed by the President, said Act to promote the efficiency of the Navy.
According to the terms of the Act, a board of naval officers has made a careful examination of the roles of the Navy, reporting those officers incapable of performing promptly and efficiently all their duty both ashore and afloat. As a result of this examination, you have been placed on this list and will receive leave of absence pay until further notice. In the meantime,
you will continue with your duties at the Naval Observatory.
He slumps in a chair, his head buried in his hands. Despair sweeps over him like the waves of his beloved ocean. And then he straightens up. His eyes are like flint.
This is wrong. Terribly wrong. I am not permitted even to know what is the accusation against me, or who my accusers are before the Navy Board. By thunder, I'll fight back. There's Tennessee hickory in my backbone.
He wrote to every member of the Navy Board that had so abruptly challenged his right to wear the uniform. They were sharp letters, full of pointed questions. But the answers were evasive.
Weasel. Only Biddle has the courage to come out and say he voted against me because of the long-ago injury to my leg and thigh. And he ignores the fact that the board itself includes a member whose leg has been broken twice over.
Meanwhile, the press of the country erupted in wrath. They put it directly up to the Congress of the United States to right the wrong done to Murray's dignity, his honor, and his pocketbook. The Congress moved with glacial slowness. It was 2 years before Murray was restored to active duty and advanced in rank.
At last, the message I have waited for. May I read it to you, my dear? It begins. Sir, the President of the United States, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate,
has appointed you a commander in the Navy from the 14th of September, 1855, on the active list. I have the pleasure to enclose herewith your commission, dated as of this instant, the 27th of January, 1858.
The final, uneasy years of that turbulent decade before the Civil War broke like a mighty and terrible storm over the land. These were years when Matthew Murray, a Southerner to the core, went about his work with a heavy heart.
In the fall of 1860, my father and mother and some of us children journeyed to New York State, and then south again to Tennessee, where my father was to speak at the laying of the cornerstone of the University of the South at Suwanee.
Here within the walls of this institution which we are preparing to establish in this wood, and the cornerstone of which has just been laid, the right-minded student of science will be brought to recognize in the dewdrop the materials of which God, who walketh upon the wings of the wind, maketh his chariot.
In his last visit to his adopted state of Tennessee, before the war broke out, Father went to England on publishing business in the winter of 1860. By the following spring, the fate of the future was sealed, and on the day, it was April 17, 1861, that his native state of Virginia left the Union, my father wrote my mother a sad letter.
Do not return to Washington, my dear Anne. I must follow the fortunes of my own state. When Virginia secedes, I will send President Lincoln my resignation from the service in which I have spent so many happy years.
Mr. Harrison, I'm ready to sign my letter of resignation.
Thomas Harrison, Commander Murray's secretary for 20 years, stood in the open doorway of the office, a paper in his hand. I cannot write it, sir.
Very well, Thomas. I appreciate your sentiment, and thank you. I'll write the letter. Do you know, Thomas, the sea is a great comfort to me. I've been thinking of it today, escaping from the tragedies of this hour. Yes, the sea is a great comfort. A very great comfort. Goodbye, Thomas.
Goodbye, sir. And good luck.
Thank you. And now I'd best write Mr. Lincoln.
So Matthew Fontaine Murray left the service of the United States Navy, which he had served for 35 years. More adventure awaited him, but at this moment he was convinced that his career was over. Sad at heart, he closed the door to his office in the Naval Observatory forever.
Way, hey, blow the man down. Pray pay attention and listen to me.
You've been listening to Tall Tales. Tonight you heard another chapter in the amazing story of Matthew Fontaine Murray. Next week we'll bring the conclusion to his stirring career. In cooperation with the Tennessee State Library, Tall Tales is making available to its listeners a reproduction of an old Indian map of Tennessee, the oldest map of the state in existence. Printed on parchment-like paper, this map is suitable for framing. For your copy, send only your name and address to Tall Tales, WSM, Nashville, Tennessee. There is no charge whatever, just send your name and address to Tall Tales, WSM, Nashville, Tennessee. And we'll send you a copy of this old Indian map of Tennessee, the oldest one in existence. That address again, Tall Tales, WSM, Nashville, Tennessee. Tall Tales is written by Bill Woolsey and comes to you each Tuesday evening at the same time. In tonight's cast were Norma Sykes, Don Moore, Henry Sullivan, and Bill Greer. The ballad singer was George Grice. Tall Tales, produced by Marjorie Cooney, is a presentation of the Department of Special Program Services and comes to you from WSM, the broadcasting service of the National Life and Accident Insurance Company in Nashville, Tennessee.